You are listening to The News Project, in studio. Brought to you by GNAT TV.
Before the COVID-19 pandemic hit, a major focus in Vermont and elsewhere around the country was on recovery from the opioid crisis. Beginning in the late 1990s, pharmaceutical companies began releasing prescription opioid pain relievers, which healthcare providers began prescribing at increasing rates. Unfortunately, these prescriptions proved highly addictive for many patients, and opioid overdose deaths began a rapid increase. In 2017, more than 47,000 Americans died from an opioid overdose. That number has continued to rise, but was leveling off and showing a slight decline, at least here in Vermont, before the pandemic arrived last spring. With healthcare resources strained to the max to help the entire population cope with COVID, resources for opioid addictions have struggled, and early signs are that 2020 will turn out to be one of the deadliest years on record. But addiction issues extend beyond opioids to other kinds of drugs and alcohol. To get a sense of how the recovery community is faring during these unusual times, we met up with Fawn Montaigne, who lives in Manchester and is the executive director of the Vermont Recovery Network, which is currently based in Manchester. The Vermont Recovery Network is a nonprofit organization that supports recovery support efforts and services for people who have experienced problems resulting from drug and alcohol use. The Vermont Recovery Center Network currently has 9 member centers and 3 affiliate centers around Vermont. A little later in our program, we'll bring in Benjamin Lerner, a musician and writer who works at the Old Mill Road Studios in East Arlington. He writes a regular column on recovery in the Vermont News Guide, titled Clean. And in January of this year, 2021, he started hosting Clean Jams on WEQX, an innovative radio program that shines a spotlight on rap, hip-hop, and recovery. So yeah, what does the Recovery Center do? What is your mission? How does it work? How do you assist folks who find their way to your door?
Right. So I think that is a great starting point. The Vermont Recovery Network is not a recovery center. We actually work to support all 12 recovery centers throughout Vermont. We provide the data platform, technical assistance, and a wide range of supports to the 12 peer-based recovery centers throughout Vermont, where we are absolutely privileged to work beside the peer professionals who are advancing access to recovery in their own communities. Each one of the 12 independent peer-based recovery centers are their own 501c3 entity. They employ people within their own community and their own recovery communities and its allies. They work with different community collaborators and different grant opportunities, as well as some of them have a lot of diversified funding. Many are heavily funded by Department of Health, and we are very thankful for the support the state gives to each center to guarantee their operations each year. And it's really wonderful because while we share a culture and philosophy in the peer-based recovery movement, each center remains completely autonomous and has the ability to respond to and best meet the needs of their own communities that they know so well.
So what is the local area recovery center? Is it, is there one in this Turning Point in Bennington, I know. Is there one in Manchester as well?
There is not one in Manchester. I moved the Vermont Recovery Network offices from Montpelier earlier this year here to Manchester. And actually, with the strategy to employ that if somebody between the catchment areas needed some space to meet with a recovery coach, they could actually utilize this office here on Main Street. For our local purposes, the Turning Point Center in Bennington is our nearest recovery center. For those on the other side of Bennington County, Turning Point Center in Rutland is also available up on State Street in Rutland. And then close by, not far, is our Turning Point Center of Springfield. So if there's folks more up in the mountain towns and up near that area, sometimes Springfield's a little bit easier for them to get to. Right now, with COVID, so much has pivoted to a virtual platform that help is available just about anywhere. And then anyone can call our inbound peer support line at 802-808-8877, and we'll answer and connect them with a peer in their own community.
So what are you seeing over the past year with COVID disrupting everything? I'm assuming, for instance, having in-person support group meetings, for one, was probably one casualty of that. And I'm sure that's been very difficult for folks who come to rely on those as a way of support, you know, to maintain, their recoveries. But is it your experience? Are you seeing, an uptick in opioid, either overdoses or evidence of people using more than they were, in part to cope with the stresses of the pandemic?
So actually, I'd love to back it up because we've seen a lot of beautiful things come out of this. We absolutely do not dispute the numbers that we see about fatal and non-fatal overdoses. We don't dispute numbers because we know how many harm reduction packs and naloxone kits that we give out. And it really, has impacted the numbers because people see more reports of fatal overdoses, but the unreported non-fatal overdoses. So the intervention is working. People are getting second chances. This is not an opioid issue, and it's quite a misnomer. The federal grants and all the money that came through 3 to 5 years ago were so opioid specific and targeting that it really did a disservice to the recovery community at large. Alcoholism is the prevalent number one untreated substance use disorder in America. I happen to be a woman in long-term recovery, and I'm a single parent. I'm coming up on 5 years myself from alcohol dependence. And, it's not so widely shared, but benzodiazepines are a part of my story. I can't tell you how many white middle-aged women have turned to wine and Xanax as a very deadly combination. Today alone, last week in Washington County, New York, which borders our neighboring counties here, we had 11 fatal overdoses due to fentanyl-laced cocaine. A few weeks ago, up in the Northeast Kingdom and up in the area of St. Albans, there was a bad batch of pills going around that were laced with fentanyl. Some of the recovery residences experienced an overdose. Their substances were poisoned with fentanyl. So it's not opioid specific by any means anymore. And we're so grateful that the state has recognized this. And they're amidst a huge anti-stigma campaign and trying to break down a lot of those boundaries and provide the education needed about substance use in general, substance misuse, and then what we don't hear enough of, that recovery is real. There are a number of people living in our communities in fulfilling, sustained recovery, but there's so much stigma around it that they're not able to, be as open as me or some other people. The meeting attendance has absolutely been impacted because people aren't able to convene in person. What that's evolved to is a wonderful web of different people connecting with people that they never would have before, because it's no longer just a mutual aid fellowship. So often people are used to hearing about an AA meeting or an NA meeting. With recovery centers and peer-based recovery, we have everything from grief and family support to different healthy exercises or exercise and wellness groups, writing groups. We have groups for family members. We have groups for new moms. We have follow-up programs for people who have recently overdosed or were engaged in services in the emergency department. But there is just a breadth and wealth of resources that are available. And although COVID has made it very, very difficult to engage with people that don't have virtual services or platforms. So you really look to our most vulnerable Vermonters with, the unmet socioeconomic needs and falling into that catchment of social determinants. Those are the folks that have been hardest to reach, but thanks to the good works and efforts of community collaborations, our recovery coaches are actually in the hotels where people are staying with vouchers, and we've been able to deploy services to the right areas.
What about treatment or rehabilitation centers? Have they been impacted by COVID? I was just trying to wonder, one hears so much about nursing homes and people living in close quarters and stuff like that. Has that made their ability to admit new people to come in for 4 weeks or 6 months or whatever their term might be?
Oh, that's a dream. People are lucky if they get 15 days anymore. And people have absolutely been impacted. So we have three full-fledged treatment centers here in Vermont. Right here in Wallingford is the Serenity House, and they can take, you know, I think between 16 and 20 people. And then there's the partnering Valley Vista facilities. The one in Vergennes is dedicated only to women. And up in Bradford, they would traditionally take male and female patients along their two wings. Because of COVID and the restrictions up in Bradford, they cut the women's unit out completely, and they're only serving the male population, and they've had to reduce their numbers and their intake criteria. And the same thing has applied to Wallingford, which is a co-ed program. Over at Brattleboro Retreat, they've sustained a further impact because of the mental health population and the parameters around that. So unless people are co-current diagnosed or really struggling, it's been challenging, but people are working diligently to ensure people can access treatments. And then our neighboring states, anyone with private insurance fares far better. Treatment is a beautiful thing. I'm a product of treatment. It's absolutely a tool, but it's not a requirement of recovery. There's plenty of people that have come into recovery, and there's plenty of people that have been to multiple treatments, but treatment ends. And that's really our mission with peer-based recovery services, to ensure that people, whether they're seeking or sustaining their recovery, are able to engage with peers that are, you know, near the same time on their path, you know, more mature on their path, but really that they know that there's options and support the whole way through. This is, again, we are peer-based recovery, so absolutely no clinical services are engaged upon at the recovery centers. It's a beautiful model because it's a peer-based recovery community center. Whether you're a person seeking or sustaining recovery or a family member, you can go into any one of them at any point in time. There's no dues, no costs, no co-pays, and you're not seeing a social worker. You're not seeing a licensed mental health counselor. You are engaging with other peers with lived experience who are just farther along their way. Any one of those recovery centers is absolutely where you need to be if you are looking to secure services or resources. We want to ensure that, you know, whatever that 8 points of wellness on the SAMHSA diagram, all those catchments are covered. Your spiritual needs, your career needs, your family needs. Are you eating? You know, how's your physical health? And then, you know, how are you connecting with people? You know, we are rooted in recovery. It's about purpose, community, and connection. I think that we're sitting in a lovely position because now recovery has been, you know, there's a hybrid. So people in recovery love convening together. We are people. We you know, associate with our own. We enjoy mutual aid meetings. We enjoy getting together to go out and to engage in social activities. The remote platform, though, has allowed us to access and interact with populations we wouldn't before. The Office of the Aging with Addiction have really pointed out how many seniors and homebound are actively engaging and bettering their health, and are acknowledging that, you know, their use of alcohol or other substances that might have been misused is on the decline because now they're engaged socially. I would hope, projection wise, I don't think it really has to do with COVID, Andrew, as much as I think it has to do with the shift in mentality. We're amidst of a payment reform in the state. We're amidst people finally looking at one another with a little bit of compassion, and asking not so much why the substance, but why the pain. And now that mental health is in the forefront and substance use is in the forefront, we have an opportunity to come together and really consolidate what we know and leverage our resources towards, you know, an overall improved quality of health. And all that comes with that mindset shift of not a treatment oriented system, but if we shift to a recovery oriented philosophy and a recovery oriented system of care, it's no longer about units of service and how many beds are available and what services somebody can do to get well. It's believing people can get well and giving them the tools to maintain what they've achieved. And that only happens in recovery and in sustained recovery.
As we said earlier, we also had the chance to speak with Benjamin Lerner, who shared his story and insights on his journey back from addiction.
My name is Benjamin Lerner. I'm a recovering heroin addict and alcoholic. My sobriety date is June 13th, 2016, chemically abstinent, clean and sober. But it's one day at a time. And I was born and raised in Washington, D.C., but Vermont's always been close to my heart. I've been coming up here since I was a little kid. And the reason I speak about that is not just because this is for a Vermont TV channel. It's because the feeling of serenity that I used to get when I came up to the trees in my dad's house in Sandgate is something I kind of chased my entire life in the form of chemicals, and even before chemicals, really just in anything that would take me out of myself. And, you know, I'm a millennial kid, so it was video games and Pokemon cards when I was growing up, anything I could turn into a compulsion. You know, it wasn't just chemicals, but, and, you know, I had a sip of wine or beer, like, you know, ceremonially at like a New Year's party. My family is very like European in that sense, you know, just like not a drink, but a taste. But I really think my first drink, other than that kind of casual ceremonial thing, was when I was 13 or 14 and I knew what alcohol did and I sought that feeling out. And it was this horrible tasting Sam Adams, you know, Oktoberfest lager that had cobwebs on it because it was hidden in some far off corner in my friend's house. And his parents had forgotten about it. So we, you know, took it and drank it. But even though it was disgusting and past its prime, the feeling it gave me was kind of this poisonous ambrosial bliss. And I chased that feeling, you know, for over a decade. From when I was 13, 14, when I was 24. And I don't need to get into the gritty details. I'm going to keep it family friendly. But what I'll say is, you know, it started out real suburban. It was like I would smoke pot or I would drink. And I'm a piano player. That's always been my discipline. I was never the greatest in school. I did all right at standardized testing. Always had somewhat of an intellectual aptitude and a love for words and music. But piano was really where I put it down in terms of my discipline. It was always what kind of redeemed me in the eyes of my parents when I was acting out and drinking and smoking. So, you know, I would get a bad score on a piano judging because I was in local competitions. I would miss a test. I would miss a track and field meet. And those were the beginning consequences. But by the end, as it spiraled out of marijuana and alcohol into substances like, you know, cocaine, heroin, opioids, I pawned everything I owned. You know, there were days I'd go days without sleeping, days without eating. And every single time that, you know, one of those consequences happened, DUI, anything like that, drop out of school, I kind of rationalized it and justified it by the actions of the people around me. Because I wasn't just addicted to the substances. I was addicted to kind of that mental pattern of justifying my own use and justifying my escapism and the perilous consequences that came with it. That I was justified in getting high. I thought that it was okay. I thought that I was actually doing people a favor because my mental baggage and my spiritual malady was as such that if I didn't have my medicine physically, mentally, spiritually calming me down and kind of, you know, making the burgeoning tide of my subconscious kind of ripple down into something manageable, then I would act out and I would take it out on people and I'd be resentful. You know, I stole from my family. Anything that you could say, relatively speaking, there were a couple lines I didn't cross, but you know, I was 24 years old as an IV heroin addict out in San Francisco, holes in my jeans, track marks on my arms. And, you know, I started out, you know, my great grandfather, his name was Irving Berlin, and he wrote a couple songs that people might be familiar with, you know, White Christmas, God Bless America. And I come from a legacy of, you know, more than any, you know, name or institution, just, you know, intellectual curiosity. Creative enterprise. And that's the legacy of my family. A lot of writers and musicians. And I went to private school, you know, Queen Mary II cruise ship trips. And here I am out in an open air drug market, counting pennies, trying to buy a bag of dope. And I still think I'm doing all right. And, you know, if it wasn't for a little voice in my head that told me that something was off, I would have kept going. Cause I still thought my solution worked. But one day, my solution stopped working, and I sought out another solution in the rooms of my sobriety fellowship. And there's a bunch of ways to find recovery, but I went to a treatment center, and I was ready. I was tired, I was exhausted, and I was ready for something different. And I was willing to listen, I was willing to learn. And I got the opportunity to go to a sober house, and I got the opportunity to get my life back. And I can talk about the amazing things recovery's given me, the trust of my family. Opportunities like coming up here to Vermont, my dad giving me the house I used to go to as a kid, working with a Dr. Joshua Sherman here, the owner and founder of Old Mill Road Media, who I write for the News Guide column and the magazines. And also, you know, Old Mill Road Recording here in East Arlington, where I'm sitting right now. where I recorded my first album, Clean, and where I record the radio show Clean Jams that we do on a weekly basis. And that's all great. But the number one thing that I would say above all that is that I learned one lesson, and it's actually what I put at the end of all my columns, which is that instead of running away from my problems, I don't want to say high, but instead of chasing that high and running away from my problems, I could get a sustainable feeling of clarity that could act in the same way as the high that I was chasing. And I just flipped the whole script, and instead of running away, I kept moving forward. I kept running towards the truth, and I kept coming back waiting for that miracle to happen. And it's a daily reprieve. It's never perfect. It's never 100% going to be the way it was before, but I have a real solution now, and it doesn't come in a bag and a bottle. It comes in a spiritual program that allows me to face my demons, face my struggle, and understand that in a lot of ways, the struggle itself and the resilience that it brings to my life was more beautiful than any high I was ever chasing.
So did that all work the first time you hit a point where you said, I just can't go this route anymore, and from there it all began to kind of come together for you? Or was it a case where you kind of had to bump up against that barrier multiple times before you kind of said, okay, I can't go on like this any longer?
Oh, I gave you the Cliff Notes version, but no, it was nothing like that. You know, I first went to treatment in December of 2012, January of 2013, and I just wasn't ready. I did it to avoid consequences. And I mean, a lot of people do that. I mean, maybe part of me thought that I was going to get sober, but I really just did it to make my family happy so that I could justify going back to school where I was, you know, getting my drugs, using the way that I wanted to. And I kind of tricked him. I was like, hey, look at me. I'm, you know, dotting all of my I's, crossing all of my T's, going to my meetings. I would go to meetings and get slips signed, but I didn't really want to get sober. Drugs were still my solution. And so, you know, I did some more research, as we like to call it. And, you know, whole thing, Suboxone, maintenance assisted treatment, in and out of outpatient rehabs because I didn't want to go back to inpatient. And actually, you know, I'll be 100% real. In the 3 years between the first time I went to treatment and the last time, knock on wood, you know, it's one day at a time. But, you know, since I got in clean and sober 4.5 years ago, it took me 3.5 years. And during that 3.5 years, my use escalated and went to places I never thought it would go. And I hated myself for it because I actually had that solution in the back of my head that rehab had given me. And even though I didn't want to get sober, I knew that it was a better way of life. And I knew that it worked for a lot of people, but I kind of justified going back to using because I was cursed with this thing I like to call terminal uniqueness, where I thought that, oh, this is a great program for them, but they haven't been through what I've been through. I'm too special. I'm too unique. This can't work for me. And that's great for them, but it's never going to work for me. And it took me a while to understand that I had to want it to work for me. And
was getting to that point, I guess I'm just wondering, is there some aspect to the whole recovery process that you think back on now as being like the hardest part, that was the most difficult thing to get past, or was it all hard?
I mean, what's interesting is that the difficulties are actually the most beautiful parts of it if you reframe it in that context. The hardest parts for me were finding purpose, you know, finding identity. I mean, if you want to talk about music, right now, Clean and the subsequent projects I'm going to be working on, it deals with positivity, it deals with grace, it deals with strength, it deals with moving forward. But my music before I got clean, besides the classical music that I did in high school, kind of my training pedigree and all that, it was all about hedonism. It was all about getting high, getting drunk, escaping consequences, and kind of glorifying that lifestyle. So I had to flip that, and I had to completely take it in a different direction. And it was almost like, I don't want to say it was invalidated, because there's a saying in my anonymous sobriety fellowship, you know, neither regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. And I don't regret my past. You know, would I have done things differently? Sure. But, you know, I learned from it. But I had to completely find a new way to live. And bigger than any housing, which is a huge challenge, finding a job is a huge challenge. But to me, that kind of, you know, factors in with the identity piece. And, you know, it was just, I had to reclaim my life. And that was tough. But the hardest thing every day was really showing up. But the way I kind of got it through my head that it was important to show up was I reminded myself, hey, did I ever not show up for the bar? Did I ever not show up to my dealer's house at 2 a.m. with all my money? So I figured if I put 10% of the same effort that I put into using and acquiring drugs and alcohol into using and acquiring lessons of sobriety, then I'd be all right. And that mantra has served me really well since then.
Hmm. So how have you felt as this past year has sort of gone forward with the whole pandemic and everything? How has that affected other people you know in recovery? Sure. Or has the pressure and stress that some people have probably experienced, whether they lost a job or their whole life has been upended in one way or another, has that been a factor you've seen playing out in the whole recovery world?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's everywhere. You know, the overdoses have increased, the alcohol, opioid, everything, relapses have increased. And I can't speak on all the societal factors that are moving that. But what I can say is that from what I've seen, both on a personal level, I'll speak for myself first. The isolation piece was really tough to deal with for me. You know, this might be a crude analogy, but I like to think addiction and COVID are very different. But I finally think that after this pandemic, people might understand or have a better understanding of what it's like to feel isolated as an addict or alcoholic in active addiction. Because COVID and, you know, addiction are both diseases that, whether we like to admit it or not, carry stigma. I mean, if you see an addict on the street who's using, you're going to have that fear. And if you see someone on a ventilator or someone who's just had COVID, you want to keep your distance. And even in the name of what we're doing now, the social distance, and it's nothing the same. I mean, you can say addiction isn't a virus, but it is, you know, pathological and it does spread. I mean, if you look at fentanyl, if you look at the way that the opioid epidemic spread and, you know, the way that addiction and alcoholism is kind of transmitted from one person to another through use patterns, it's nothing the same, but there are parallels that are interesting. And the main parallel is that the fear and self-doubt, you know, from the social distancing that can come in when you're a recovering addict and alcoholic. I know for me that, like, when the pandemic first started, I hadn't felt that sense of fear and self-doubt and isolation since I was an active addict using out in my room in California before I got clean. And in terms of, you know, logistical challenges, we've had to integrate all of these new things in the recovery community overnight as a result of the pandemic. You know, in the beginning, people had to kind of scramble to figure out, because for people who lived with immunocompromised stuff before, like, you know, people who lived within, like, I don't know the correct term, but ventilator tubes, or had to be isolated because of complete lack of immunity, Zoom meetings already existed. And also for people who were overseas, but it was a tiny community. And, you know, regardless of your fellowship, I'm not going to speak on my fellowship because that's against the traditions, but every recovery fellowship has Zoom meetings now. And they're so helpful. I mean, it helped me to reach out to my fellowship, feel a sense of connection. Another thing that I've seen as being helpful is that, you know, even though a lot of treatment has been forced to pivot, for lack of a better term, a lot of organizations have come together, especially, you know, here in Southern Vermont, to do community outreach to fill in the gaps. They've distributed some harm reduction bags to people in high-risk situations, like living in hotels and, you know, on the street or in, you know, things like that. And it's been said that the opposite of addiction is connection, like I said before, and people are really going out of their way to make sure people remain connected in terms of treatment, in terms of meetings, in terms of everything. But the pandemic has really made a lot of that harder.
For the GNAT TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever.
Thank you for listening local. For more local content, visit GNAT.tv.